Mars is an elastic planet. Things bounce, things cohere, and things snap. You are on a train. It is 1947. And as you steam your way through a dark autumn landscape, you shiver from the chill. Outside, a cruel wind swindles branches of their leaves, while vicious hailstones tap ill-tempered rhythms against the window. There are five other people in this carriage with you, and it is possible they have nothing in common. One is reading a book, one is humming a tune, another is napping loudly. A fourth is writing in a notebook. And the fifth? Well, let us start with him.
Next stop, Wheelbull, then fast for Kedchester.
But we'd better hurry, as that is your stop. The gentleman in question wears a hood, and at first you think him a monk. But no, for this man is a fish head. His body, from the shoulders up, is actually that of a fish.
Fish heads. Up to the middle of the 15th century, such individuals were a common sight in these isles, sharing many of our larger towns with normal heads. However, in 1433, a panic about falling fish stocks spread across the land. Long simmering accusations that the fish heads were telling fish how to avoid the fishermen's nets soon surfaced, and the community was expelled from England. Many died in the infamous St. Barkwood's Day riots.
In a scene invariably cut from modern productions of Henry VI, Part 3, Shakespeare's view of the expulsion of the fish heads is made clear. Robert Stevens of the RSC discusses the scene in BBC Two's The Play's the Thing.
This Piscean menace, these men whose heads share not the image of our Maker, rather the countenance of a cod. Whom do they serve, us or some watery master whose name they utter in their fishy tongue.
So why do you think most directors choose to drop this scene?
For length reasons, mainly. It doesn't add anything to the main thrust of the plot, and for an audience unfamiliar with the persecution of the fish heads, I think it just confuses.
But you like it?
I do. I think it's very powerful. The way Shakespeare treats Jews in The Merchant of Venice, or the working classes in a number of plays. The fish heads here, the outsiders, the dispossessed. It's tremendously interesting for an actor. It's important to get inside these people's heads.
Not literally, though.
They're pretty heavy, those masks.
No answer, sir. Do you have no defence?
He'll say nothing, my liege. He dare not, for his guilt be as plain as his gills. Speak! Blub, blub, blub,
blub, blub, blub. The remnants of the English fish head population relocate to the North Spanish coast, but their numbers dwindle over the years. And when, in 1902, our fellow passenger Bloodaggle Glubbubbledup is born, fewer than 100 remain to continue their unique lifestyle. In 1933, Bloodaggle leaves his village and goes to work for Salvador Dali as a watchmelter and cloud arranger. But life as a painter's assistant is limiting for him, and he decides to come to England to see the homeland of his ancestors. It is this pilgrimage that brings him onto this train today.
These seats are rather uncomfortable,
he says, with only the slightest hint of a fish head accent. And he is right, for the seats on British trains have remained uncomfortable since the days of the Second World War, when furniture rationing was a fact of life. The lack of experienced carpenters on the home front meant that Churchill entrusted Sir Jasper Kelty, the former head of the National Shoe Board, with an expanded Ministry of Furniture to overcome the problem.
That chair is needed. That table is needed. Stools, cupboards, and chests of drawers. All are needed.
Well, I never. But why?
That chair is needed by the RAF as a cockpit seat for an airman. That table is needed by Army Command to move pieces of wood around on so we know where our troops are. Stools are needed on fighting ships where chairs are unwieldy. That cupboard in a barracks. That chest of drawers for the Royal Marines. All are needed.
We must all do our best to support our men and women at arms. Now, if that means going without a chair so that a brave pilot can meet his challenge in the air, or a table so that our commanders are more easily able to plan engagements, then I know the British people will not hesitate to shoulder this burden.
It is this same Sir Jasper Kelty who now sits in the far corner of the carriage, writing in his notebook. Before his promotion, he had been the junior minister in charge of counter-defence, where his brief had been to make it difficult for possible enemy paratroopers to find their way around the country. After taking down road signs all over the countryside, he orders that place names be spoonerized to further confuse possible invaders. Thus, Bognor Regis becomes
Rognor Beegis.
Herne Bay becomes
Burn Hay.
And Wellin Garden City is renamed
Gelwyn Sudden Witty
for the duration of the war. Kelty's assistant at this time is Linton Swalecliffe. Obsessed with opposing the Fifth Column active at the time, Swalecliffe organises Sixth and Seventh Columns to sabotage the work of the saboteurs. Swalecliffe is killed by a carpet bomb in 1942, during the height of the German carpet bombing campaign, but his youngest surviving daughter is now sitting opposite Kelty in the carriage. Phaedra Swalecliffe is a prodigiously intelligent 15-year-old. At the age of 3, when most youngsters play with imaginary friends, she was already playing with imaginary numbers. Her mother tells a meeting of the Women's Union of her daughter's abilities.
Phaedra never ceases to amaze us. When she was just 8 years of age, she spent a whole weekend relisting the London telephone directory in numerical order. She has found it hard to mix with children of her own age and has consequently taken up solitary pursuits. She can often be seen playing chess against a wall in our back garden and passes evenings translating the Old Testament into semaphore.
It is Phaedra's grandfather, Obadiah Meltooth, who is the author of the great history of the fish heads, Cod and Mammon, and it is this work that provides the inspiration for Bloodaggle to make his long trip. The book Phaedra is reading is A Stiff Upper Lip by Clara Nomran. Set during the Great Moustache Race of 1911, when the Daily Sketch offered £5,000 to the gentleman growing the finest moustache by Derby Day, it details, but Phaedra cannot concentrate on the details, as the man across from her and to her right is continually humming. This is not entirely surprising, however, as he is Fardru Maletto, the renowned baritone, who has just broadcast on the BBC an interview regarding his latest production. This is the opera Dolph Svengor, universally acknowledged among singers to be unlucky, and usually only referred to as the Swedish opera, or the S.O.
So, Mr. Maletto, would you tell the listeners about some of the ill fortune that has dogged past productions of this piece?
Asks Florence to Van Smetten on the third service.
Well, at the premiere in 1902, a chandelier fell on the audience, killing 30 people and injuring dozens more. In other productions over the years, sets have fallen down, singers have lost their voices, whole rows of seats have been stolen from the auditoria. All have led to cancelled performances.
And in 1906?
Ah, yes. At a production in San Francisco, they thought everything had gone without a hitch. Then, during the final bow, the great earthquake struck. But these are in night and days, Florence. Talk of the opera itself being unlucky is, well, I should venture to say sheer poppycock.
Extracts from the Swedish opera are sung at the 1976 proms.
Good evening and welcome. You join us at the Royal Albert Hall this evening for a performance of arias from Menborsen's Dolph Svengar. The opera tells of Dolph, a young shepherd, and his encounters with a gang of comical sheep shearers, Loppo, Wedgar, Sintuna, and Basp, who wish to shear his sheep. Dolph's escape from the four takes him to the land of no trees nor lakes, a country where trees and lakes are absent. His lament, "I wish there were trees or even a lake," is sung tonight by Oh dear.
Meletto is also a leading expert on primitive cuisine and regularly dines at Le Neolith, a Stone Age restaurant in Mayfair. A review by Letitia Neckhead sums up the experience of dining at the establishment.
The excellent ambience is achieved with cave paintings on the wall and smoky fires throughout. Apprehensive patrons are dragged to a table by their hair. We began with a wooden bowl of berries in ash, complemented by the lukewarm and greyish soup of 1,000 nuts. A dull tang of weed roots was noticeable, and that is, I'm sure, how the diner at the dawn of time would have enjoyed his hors d'oeuvre.
The craze is brought to an abrupt halt in the summer of 1939 with the exposure of the Piltdown stew hoax, when the recipes are proven to be combinations of much younger dishes. Sir Jasper Kelty, a co-owner of Linnaeolith before the scandal breaks, is almost forced to resign, but he retains his post when he orders the restaurant's closure. Redundancies are inevitable, and among those fired is the grass chef, Wallace Denflavelli, who is the man now snoring on the shoulder of Fardru Maletto. Denflavelli blames Kelty for the loss of his job and sets about the latter one evening in 1937. The fight is broken up by one Rudyard Edgeblair, an astronomer, who is on his way to dine with Angela Tiss. Tiss, the woman of whom Dorothy Parker once wrote,
"The general reader greets a new novel by her in much the same way as the prodigal son was greeted by the fatted calf,"
writes using the pseudonym Clara Nomran. As well as a stiff upper lip, she is the authoress of Open Seas, Closed Hearts, an epic set aboard a ship attacked by marauding pirate Methodists in the early 19th century.
The pirate Methodists were indeed much feared. They identified their targets from the horizon and then attacked swiftly and without mercy. They boarded the ship and quickly set up Bible study groups and prayer meetings on all decks before abandoning the now stricken vessel to seek out other prey. The effect was always devastating. Dorothea had heard of whole fleets that had been left, drifting, without the will to dance or drink. In her heart, she knew they would treat her most cruelly, taking away her pretty dresses and leaving her a dowdy frock. Her hair would be tied back plainly, and her sense of fun extinguished. Pirates they were indeed that stole not treasure, but pleasure.
Angela Tiss and Rudyard Edgeblair are engaged in 1940. By then, Rudyard has already embarked upon his massive substitute Zodiac, which he completes in 1953.
Well, you see, Edgeblair's work is tremendously important. The light we receive here on Earth from the stars in the night sky is, in many cases, millions and millions of years old. So distant are these bodies away from us that it's entirely possible that over the period between the moment the star transmits its light and when we see it, that the star has exhausted itself and no longer exists. Now, if this were indeed the case, we clearly need a new map of the stars, and that's what Edgeblair provided us with in 1953. In all likelihood, generations of future astronomers will not observe Taurus the Bull, Orion the Hunter, or the Plough when they gaze into the heavens, but his new constellations of Fido the Poodle, Atco the Lawnmower, or Champion the Wonder Horse.
Tiss and Edgeblair's wedding is at the Church of St. Lawrence the Bearded in the small town of Whitlable, which happens to be the home of Wallace Denflavelli, as well as the site of the first St. Bargwood's Day riots that drove the fishheads from Britain, the constituency seat of Sir Jasper Kelty, the location of Fardru Maletto's performance tonight, and of Phaedra Swalecliffe's school, Beedean. All of which means there'll be an almighty rush when the train stops there. But Whitlable is still 10 minutes away, and that thought consoles you as the train journeys onward into the night.
Elastic Planet was written by Ben Moore and featured the voices of Oliver Postgate, Miriam Margulies, Dan Strauss, Michael Troughton, Neil Malarkey and Ben Moore, with Patrick Moore, Richard Baker and Sir Robert Stevens as themselves. The producer was John Naismith.